haven't thought about it much since the Cold War, so why be concerned about nuclear war now? Catch up with Kirby Anderson now on Probe.
Annie Jacobson begins her book with a scenario. A 1 megaton thermonuclear bomb strikes the Pentagon and vaporizes the building and the 27,000 employees within it. A mile away, the marble columns of the Lincoln and Jefferson memorials burst apart and disintegrate. 2.5 miles west at National Park, the clothes of the majority of the 35,000 people watching the ball game catch on fire. Her book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, takes you through in a minute-by-minute description of what would happen if a bolt-out-of-the-blue nuclear attack took place on U.S. soil. This 370-page book isn't for the faint-hearted, but it is an in-depth investigation in how we got to this place in world history and what would happen if the unthinkable became reality. And the book provides a sequel to the 2023 biographical film Oppenheimer. Why are we discussing this difficult topic of nuclear war now? Well, first, there's a need to educate a new generation. Although Americans talked about the danger of nuclear war during the Cold War years, much less has been said in recent years. Second, the threat of nuclear war is even greater today because of countries like North Korea that have nuclear weapons and other countries like Iran that have been attempting to develop nuclear weapons. Third, this discussion is relevant because so many documents about nuclear war have been declassified. You know, it is impossible for our minds to comprehend what happens in a nuclear blast. The air heats to 180 million degrees Fahrenheit. This is nearly 5 times hotter than the temperature in the center of the sun. The blast levels any structure within miles and also creates winds traveling at several hundred miles an hour. The nuclear fireball then rises like a hot air balloon, forming the iconic mushroom cloud with cap and stem. Then the inferno begins. Gas lines explode and look like giant blowtorches. Washington, D.C. has now become a mega inferno. Asphalt streets turn to liquid from the intense heat, and more than 1 million people are dead or dying within 2 minutes after the detonation. Outside the blast area, the electromagnetic pulse obliterates all radio, television, and internet. Cars with electronic ignition systems cannot start, water stations cannot pump water, and deadly radiation spreads to those who survive the initial blast. Nuclear war may be unthinkable, but that is why we'll be thinking about it and talking about it this week.
You've been listening to Probe with your host, Kirby Anderson. To get your free copy of Kirby's transcript, Nuclear War, go to probe.org. That's probe.org. Then join us next time as we help you recognize the times and heed the warnings here on Probe.
This week we're talking about nuclear war, and today we will see how fast it could develop and devastate our world. An intercontinental ballistic missile is a long-range missile that delivers nuclear weapons to political and military targets on the other side of the world. These ICBMs exist to kill millions of people in another country. When the ICBM was invented, Herb York, the Pentagon's chief scientist, wanted to calculate how many minutes it would take for it to reach the Soviet Union. A group of defense scientists estimated that it would take 26 minutes and 40 seconds. From launch to annihilation takes just 1,600 seconds. Nuclear war happens too fast. Today, that estimate varies because we have 9 countries that possess nuclear weapons: Russia, France, China, Pakistan, India, Israel, North Korea, the UK, and the US. Given North Korea's geographical location, the launch to target time frame from the Korean Peninsula to the east coast of the United States would be about 33 minutes. But a nuclear blast can come even sooner from nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered submarines. These submarines are called boomers, or even have been called the handmaidens of the apocalypse. They are undetectable under the sea and can sneak up very close to a nation's coast and launch a first strike attack. That is why the president actually only has a 6-minute window to decide on a nuclear counterattack. And America has a policy known as launch on warning. What that means is America will launch its nuclear weapons once its early warning electronic sensor system warns of an impending nuclear attack. Put another way, the U.S. won't wait to check if a warning is accurate. It will not wait and physically absorb a nuclear blow before launching its own nuclear weapons at whoever sent a missile to them. This policy has been in place since the height of the Cold War and represents an incredibly high risk. As one advisor explains, launch on warning during a time of intense crisis is a recipe for catastrophe. Now, presidential candidates have proposed to change this policy, but nothing has happened so far. George W. Bush in 2000 vowed to address this policy, saying keeping so many weapons on high alert may create an unacceptable risk for accidental unauthorized launch. Barack Obama argued that keeping nuclear weapons ready to launch at a moment's notice is a dangerous relic of the Cold War. President Biden has been encouraged to eliminate this perilous policy, but no change has been made. The decision to launch a nuclear strike comes from the president. How did the government decide to give the president the nuclear football? Well, the story begins with Harold Agnew back in 1959. He visited a NATO base and noticed that there were four F-84F aircraft at the end of the runway. Each was carrying two nuclear gravity bombs. This meant that these nuclear bombs were in the custody of one U.S. Army private armed with an M1 rifle with eight rounds of ammunition. The only safeguard against unauthorized use of an atomic bomb was this single GI surrounded by numbers of foreign troops on foreign territory with thousands of Soviet troops just miles away. When he got back to the U.S., Agnew contacted a project engineer at Sandia Laboratories and asked if they could put on an electric lock on the bomb's firing circuits that would prevent others from arming the nuclear bomb. They produced a lock-encoded switch that would be activated with a three-digit code. They presented the idea and the device to the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy and then to President Kennedy, who ordered it to be done. But the military objected. A general asked how a pilot somewhere in the world could get a code from the President of the United States to arm a nuclear weapon before being overrun by a massively superior number of Soviet troops. And they also asked why not having other nuclear bombs also coded. The answer came in the creation of the president's football, which is an emergency satchel. This gave the president, not the military, control of America's nuclear arsenal, and the football must always be near the president. There's a story of how important it is for the president to have access to the football. When President Clinton was visiting Syria, President Hafez al-Assad's handlers tried to prevent Clinton's military aide from riding in an elevator with him. The Secret Service would not let that happen and did not let that happen. Inside is a set of documents known as the Black Book. Robert Buzz Patterson served as a military aide to President Clinton, and I was able to interview him one time on my radio program. He likened the Black Book to a Denny's breakfast menu because of how it looked. The president must choose retaliatory targets from a predetermined nuclear strike list on the menu. Let me end with this question. Do you believe the current president has a mental capacity to make a rational decision about launching nuclear weapons? One question that was asked more than 40 years ago was whether anyone could win a nuclear war. Spoiler alert, no one can. President Reagan ordered a simulated war game with the name Proud Prophet to explore the outcome and long-term effects of a nuclear war. The research used mathematical models to predict outcomes and was conducted at the National War College. Participants were cloistered away inside a secure location to prevent leaks. The results were only declassified in 2012, but much of the material was blacked out. Fortunately, this declassification allowed participants to discuss it without violating the Espionage Act of 1917. Over the 2 weeks, every simulated scenario ended the same way. Sometimes they began with a tactical nuclear strike and a so-called limited nuclear war. Other times they simulated exercises with NATO and then with other exercises without NATO. There were scenarios where the U.S. launched nuclear war preemptively. Sometimes that was when the Pentagon was supposedly in a focused calm and others when in a crisis mode. Sadly, the result was the same. Once a nuclear war starts, there is no way to win it or even end it. No matter how a nuclear war begins, it ends with complete Armageddon-like destruction. As one participant put it, the destruction made all the wars of the past 500 years pale in comparison. At least a half a billion and probably more like a billion people die in the war's opening salvo, then billions more die of radiation poisoning and starvation. When the bombs cease striking targets, the world turns dark and cold. Everything is on fire. Smoke produces noxious smog of pyrotoxins. Fires in the cities ignite other fires. Even in the less populated areas, forest fires rage. The density of the soot reduces global temperatures by 20 to 40 degrees depending on the location. Earth plunges into the horror known as a nuclear winter. This might be a familiar term for those of us who lived in the 1980s. Astronomer Carl Sagan wrote about it and warned us of the dangers of nuclear war. A nuclear war would change the troposphere and thus the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth. Once the radioactive fog and haze diminish, the ozone layer disappears and the sun's warming rays are now killer UV rays. Earth is no longer as hospitable to humans as it once was. After millennia of planting and harvesting, the few humans to survive return to a hunter-gatherer existence. This week we've been talking about nuclear war and we'll conclude with a biblical perspective. Let's begin with the realization that God is sovereign and in control. But that doesn't mean that he would never allow a nuclear war to take place. Throughout history, we have had tyrants and armies destroy people groups and civilizations. God used pagan nations to judge the nation of Israel. How should we respond? Since the first atomic bombings at the end of World War II, there has been a condition known as nuclear anxiety. Jesus instructs us not to be anxious about tomorrow, and Paul also tells us not to be anxious about anything. Jesus even says that if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. In the book of Daniel, we have another reminder of God's sovereignty that came in the second dream of Nebuchadnezzar. It reminded him of the fact that God rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets it over the lowliest men. Nebuchadnezzar knew more about human sovereignty than anyone and proclaimed God's sovereignty over the earth at the end of his days. Now, some Christians have suggested that the Bible may be describing a nuclear war. In the book of Revelation, there's a description of the poisoning of the waters, the death of the earth's vegetation, the end of ocean life, and the inability to block the sun's rays resulting in severe burns. There is a description of stars of heaven falling to earth that some have suggested might be describing nuclear missiles raining down on earth during a nuclear war. These would be visible as they enter the atmosphere and begin striking the cities of earth. Even passages in the Old Testament might point to the effects of a nuclear war. For example, in Zechariah 14, we read that the Lord will strike all the peoples that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. One prophecy yet to be fulfilled can be found in Ezekiel 38 that describes nations that will come against Israel. But critics point to the fact that it says that they are riding horses, wearing helmets and armor, and wielding swords. That doesn't look like a modern army. But I remember a famous quote from Albert Einstein. "I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones." The world might look very different after a nuclear war. This week we've been discussing the unthinkable, a nuclear war. We should remember the words of Jesus, "In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world."